Good morning and welcome everyone to Live Dharma Sunday for August 9th, 2015. Koyo Kubose here. So very glad you joined us. This morning, I'd like to start out with talking about the traditional use of bells in Buddhism. The big, the large hanging bells. And there are two types. One is a kansho, which means calling bell. And this kansho is a medium-sized bell, maybe 2 to 3 feet tall. And it's usually hung near the altar area of a temple. And it is rung immediately before the start of a religious service to call all the members of the Sangha. And then it's struck in a certain traditional pattern with a wooden mallet. And this tradition is followed for every Sunday service for Jodo Shinshu temples here in America. And the other bell is a large bell called a bonsho, which means Indian bell. And this is a bell that originated in India. But it's a large bell, maybe 4 to 10 feet or more tall, weighing as much as several tons. There's not that many temples that in America that have bonsho, but quite common for many temples in Japan. And being 10 feet tall or more and weighing, over 20 tons, it's usually suspended in a separate bell tower that's built specially for it. The most famous bell in India was hung in the garden where Shakyamuni Buddha resided, and was said to have weighed 50 tons. And its sound reminded all who heard it of the impermanence of all component things. The largest bonsho in Japan is at the Chioin Temple in Kyoto and weighs approximately 29 tons. Now, the bonsho is struck just above the outside lip with a section of tree trunk. It's a log, maybe 6 to 8 feet long, a foot or so in diameter, and this log is hung by ropes so that it could swing horizontally and strike the bell. This bonsho was widely used in China, Korea, and Japan to also summon followers to the temple, and in many cases to mark the time of the day. One ritual is that it struck 108 times on the last night of the year. And to get rid of the 108 bonno, or delusions and human passions and limitations. Traditionally, the bonsho was rung 10 times in the morning, 7 times in the afternoon, 7 times in the evening. In some villages and farming communities, the bonsho very often marked the hours of work and rest. In Japan especially, the sound of the bonsho came to be regarded as the voice of the Buddha. Well, there's a couple of stories that I have. The bonsho was one time, I guess my father took a few members of his temple on a trip to Japan, and they traveled around, and one of his disciples, a Caucasian man, his name was James, and visited one temple where there was this big boncho, and James moved, swung the log back and swung it forward and rang the boncho. And the story that he told was that he said, your father said, no, James, here's how you do it. And he said, my father started to swing that log back and forth in a pendulum action. And then on one of the back swings, he took it way back, so far back that his feet left the ground, and then he ran forward and ran that log into the bell. Boom! I just can't imagine my father doing such a vigorous, maybe almost violent action. But I always have that image. That's quite an image in my mind. Now the concho, the calling bell, I have a little one that's only about maybe a foot high, and then I have a little, and I could hold it with one hand, and this is sort of a portable one. I carry it in travels if I'm doing a service someplace else, and sometimes I strike it in the calling pattern and use that. But we do have a concho at our spot here at Bright Dawn Center. Our spot is a little building behind our house. It's a former playhouse that was built by the former owners. They were in construction work and they had three young daughters. And the father built this playhouse for them, a big playhouse, maybe 10 by 12 feet. But we converted it into a repository to store religious artifacts and also have some meditation cushions in there, and has a little porch. So outside in the front porch, we hung our concho, which is about, I guess maybe three, four feet tall. Must weigh at least a couple hundred pounds. And I remember when LM2 was here, we hung it. We needed help and, to hang it. There's a sort of a framework, in which wooden framework which was built to hold this concho. And we have a wooden mallet and sometimes just for no reason I might go hit the concho. And I'll tell you a story. Children growing up, we didn't know that much Japanese, but we knew certain words. And one word, when I first learned about concho bells, my ears perked up because it sounded very close to another word called concho. Concho, the bell is K-A-N-S-H-O, concho. The other word is concho, a C instead of an S. And a concho is an enema. And then many years later, I thought, well, concho, an enema, in a concho, a calling bell, hey, maybe that's a good sort of teaching, because just like a concho enema, the concho calling bell, they both involve a purging or emptying out of, well, different things, but for the concho, the calling bell, is to, the sound of the bell helps to kind of a mental cleansing. Get rid of the extraneous thoughts. You get called to the service. You empty your mind out so that you can receive the service. So this is just a personal sharing, but every time I think about the concho, I think about concho. Not something that you would really share to everybody, but it went out in this broadcast. Well, I better move on. I'd like to introduce today's guest to give us a Dharma glimpse. This is Paul Toyo, who lives in Missouri, professional educator, now retired. He was part of our LM2 group. And we'd like to hear from Paul Toyo this morning.
Good morning. I'm going to read an essay I wrote for the occasion. The title is August 9th. Just a date, right? Falling inexorably between August 8th and August 10th. August 9th also falls 3 days after August 6th, right? Quiz. What world-changing event happened on August 6th? How about August 9th? These are world birthdays of sorts, more often days of commemoration, but not necessarily celebration. In case you aren't sure, I'll tell you that August 6th and August 9th mark the beginning of the world nuclear age, born from the dropping of a uranium bomb on Hiroshima, Japan, and, due to poor visibility over a different site, dropping of a plutonium bomb on Nagasaki, Japan. The destruction was complete, and many thousands died. You can read John Hershey's 1946 book, Hiroshima, or a first-hand report from September 1945 by an Australian journalist, Wilfred Burchett, which published in the Guardian newspaper and was titled The Atomic Plague. I write this as a warning to the world. There are, of course, many Japanese accounts from writers, poets, and everyday citizen participants, many of whom were quite unwilling participants and observers. A good start is a book titled Black Rain. My task here is to write about the Dharma, the life lessons. What can we learn? Many justifications for the bombing, as well as condemnations, have flown back and forth in the past 70 years. The bombings evoke strong reactions, even so long afterward. There are as many questions as answers. Were the actions inevitable? There are always choices, right? So what, if any, were the choices? We learn backward, but we move forward. So then, moving forward, what have we learned? For me, one very intriguing yet unanswerable question hinges on the possible misinterpretation of a word in the Japanese Prime Minister's July 28th response to the initial Allied demand for unconditional surrender. He may have been addressing hardliners who were contemplating fighting on, but his audience of Allied leaders interpreted the word mokusatsu, as silent contempt. Possibly what he meant was, quote, let it pass without comment or action, unquote. An immediate result of this interpretation by the Allies was the first ever, and so far only, atomic bombing of two cities, with the resultant slaughter of many civilians. Civilian support for a war may be presumed by one's adversaries to be unanimous, but if you know any protesters of the Vietnam or Iraq wars, you know this disdain so. The 20th century has witnessed the increasing targeting of civilians as a war tactic, based on an assumption of civilian complicity in the enemy's actions. Not very compassionate, to say the least. As a teacher of economic concepts, I tell my students, choices have consequences. Parents, I hope my children would think carefully about the costs as well as the benefits of their actions. What then are the costs to total high-tech war at a distance? What are the benefits? Who pays the costs, and who reaps the benefits? Would the Buddha say the end justifies the means, or would he rather posit that they are the same, inseparable, non-dualistic? The means are the ends, and the ends are the means. Did you know, for example, that less than 2% of the Hiroshima bomb actually detonated? if 100% had detonated, there would have been a 100-mile circle of destruction. The bomb architects and deployers were experimenting on civilians with amateur indifference. The Nagasaki bomb was plutonium because the architects and deployers wanted to see what the differences were between uranium and plutonium. Means to ends, who pays and who collects. Lessons learned in moving forward. Since recent events with North Korea and Iran, North Korea ignored its signing of the Non-Proliferation Act and detonated a nuclear bomb. Iran signed, but skeptics abound. So here's a final quote from a British artist and critic, John Berger. He says, "Evil from time immemorial has often worn a mask of innocence. One of evil's principal modes of being is looking beyond with indifference that which is before its eyes. Buddha tells us to believe only what we can see and experience ourselves. May it be so. Basho."
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. I know that 75th anniversary the 70th, I guess. Yeah, 70th anniversary. And there's been some articles in the newspapers. And, of course, in Hiroshima City itself, there's one kind of like a tower building that survived the bombing and was preserved as a historical monument. And that area right there has been turned into a museum. And when we visited Japan and visited Hiroshima, we went to the Peace Park. And Japan is a very, unique country in that the Constitution, which was written during the occupation after the war, together with the United States, its Constitution based upon peace. And by law, Japan military cannot be used in any offensive way, only for defensive purposes. And, of course, no nuclear program or for weapons. And this is always a contentious political issue because how do you define defense if some country is encroaching on some Japanese territories or interests economically? Can they show a presence and send some ships to in the area? So there's always contention domestically in Japan. I read some articles that certain politicians may be more hawkish and try to push the boundaries of military power, whereas then the more peace factions would have a protest and so forth. So it's a very dynamic kind of situation about the military, force. And I think this is true in any country, like in America, decision to invade Iraq, the hawks versus the doves, and the kind of perspective, the kind of values that are there. Pacifism. I think of Quakers. I think about conscientious objectors. I think about things like that. And the role of war in human history, innocent civilians being killed. America is very fortunate in that there's been no war on its home ground. We haven't had, as citizens, haven't had that kind of experience. And it's hard for me to imagine how civilian life in other countries where, you know, the war is right around everyone, you know, around where children are growing up. How does it affect their outlook on life when it's right around them? In any case, Paul Toyo, who recorded his talk ahead of time, but he also gave us a hard copy, and he wanted to make sure that it was all right for him to talk about this topic. And, you know, of course, Buddhism, I think, could really be in the vanguard of pacifism, its teachings. Every year around this time, I have a good friend in Chicago, Phil Goff, who, in fact, when I got the Concho bell, the one that I told you is about 3-4 feet tall, 200 pounds, traditional Concho bell, I needed to get a way to hang it. And so he's a woodworker. So Phil built me a framework to hold the bell. And he made a little model, a small miniature model, okay, to test out the construction method. And then he built a larger model, a larger actual thing, and we had it in Chicago in our home. And every New Year's Eve, in fact, as I mentioned earlier, we had always had a New Year's Eve gathering at my house, and one of the rituals was to ring that bell. Everybody rang it so many times, we kept track for the 108 ritual ringing out at the end of the year, getting rid of our 108 bonal human delusions and limitations. Sometime we even wrote one of the things that maybe it's some kind of a bad habit or bad trait, personality trait of oneself, and write it on a piece of paper, fold it up, and part of the ritual was to throw that and burn it up in our fireplace, things like that. And now that when we moved to California, of course, we brought Boncho with us, and as I said, it's now in the front porch of the spot. Spot means, is an acronym for special place of tranquility. And every year around this time, I get a card from Phil with a memorial donation dedicated for observance of Hiroshima Nagasaki Day. And I'm looking at the card that I received for this year. And it just so happened, I don't know if he intended it or not, but it's a wildlife card. It's a picture of an owl's face on the front. And it's an Audubon card. And Barred owl, B-A-R-R-E-D, barred owl.
But, you know, of course, owls just, for some reason, symbolize wisdom. I just thought of it right now, that association. I had another friend who collected figurines of owls, had a big collection. Pretty nice. But, so I read into this picture of an owl on this card as, hey man, we need some more wisdom in this world. Huh? When are we going to shape up? Maybe never completely, but we've got to know that we're, be aware that we've got to move in the right direction. Even if it's too idealistic of thinking about no wars. In his card, he says, sending you happy thoughts and smiles. Please ring the bell for Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We Hyde Parkers should be especially aware since it all started at 57th and Ellis. Love, Phil. Hyde Parkers refers to Hyde Park High School on the south side of Chicago. And in the Hyde Park neighborhood, which was close to the University of Chicago. And 57th and Ellis, well, that's where the scientists developed the atomic bomb. Piece of history there. But so, the concho, we could add one of the purposes or functions of ringing the bell could be as a memorial. And not only should we think about world peace, but peace begins at home. Peace begins with me. 108 Bono, ringing, getting rid of our own greed and anger, ignorance, peace. May we have peace, and may it begin with me. Thank you very much. That's all for today's broadcast. Till next time, keep going, and you have a very wonderful day. Thank you.